You're listening to That Life Then, The Glass Facade, written and read by Jack Merrill. When I was growing up in Evanston, Illinois, there were never any discussions at home concerning how one made money or prepared oneself for a career. In my family, money just flowed. It was always enough so all the basics were covered, and I was left to assume that somehow it would just keep on flowing. No strategy was ever presented on how one made money, and conversely, there was no strategy on how one spent it. Oh, wait. One thing I was taught about spending was to only shop at the best department stores, preferably Marshall Field's or Saks Fifth Avenue. That I was told over and over. As I got older, it was hard for me to understand the logic behind spending. For example, if I wanted the newest Vask hiking boots or the green striped Adidas that all my friends were wearing, I wasn't allowed to get them. Yet some insanely expensive pair of shoes from Saks that I didn't want in the first place? No problem. You see, my mother liked Saks, and she held on to all the purchasing power with an iron fist. My mother didn't like the idea of independence when it came to her children, and something as simple as choosing your own shoes could lead to independent thoughts, which could lead to individual choices and personal decision-making and the exercise of free will, all things that would lead to an erosion of her power. Another example. My mother would frequently sneer that me and my so-called friends had no individuality because we all wanted to wear similar clothes and specific brands. The way I saw it, that was the expression of my individuality. What I wore was my identification and my alignment with my friends. Now look, I know this kind of teenage nonsense is typical, but what was unusual was that unlike all the other mothers I knew, mine refused any opinions. There were brutal fights just because I asked in the first place. It was crazy. I mean it. My father, who was the source of all this flow, was busy being successful and had given the power of the purse to my mother, as he didn't want to spend even a moment on such trivial nonsense as what I wanted to wear to school. As far as he was concerned, I was fucking lucky. He never wore anything from Marshall Field's when he was my age, and I should just shut the fuck up and wear whatever it was my mother bought me. But the thing was, these issues ran deeper than choosing footwear. And my mother's abusive infantilization of her children caused my older sisters to get jobs out in the world very early on, not just so they could get out of the house, but so they'd also be in a position to have some dough of their own to spend on clothes or whatever it was they wanted. Sounded good to me. If a job got you out of the house, and maybe those green-striped Adidas, I wanted one too. In my family, it was understood that in order to get yourself a job, the road to employment was simple. You dressed in the nice clothes you'd been bought from Fields or Saks, and then you walked nearby to wherever it was your feet took you, stopping into whatever establishments you came across along the way. You'd enter one of these places of business that you happened upon, and you asked whoever it was who was working there if they were hiring. If they liked the way you looked in the nice clothes you'd been bought from Fields or Saks, they hired you. It was simple. That's how you got a job. So that's exactly what I did. I put on one of my expensive, uncomfortable outfits my mother chosen for me from Saks or Fields, complete with a pair of uncomfortable, good, proper shoes. And by good and proper, I mean hard-soled, shiny, laced-up leather shoes. Loafers did not make the cut. Leather shoes needed laces. My mother was also a one-woman, hard-line lobbyist against what she saw as the dreaded encroachment of gym shoes. She was convinced that such soft footwear was not only low-class, but they ruined your feet forever. Having double-tied my Buster Brown-type shiny leather shoes, I clip-clopped my way out of my family's front door for a three-block clip-clop up Dempster Street to a commercial corner where Dempster crossed Chicago Avenue. There's no doubt that if I'd passed by Baskin-Robbins 31 Flavors ice cream store, which was right on the corner, and instead continued another block up Dempster Street, turning into Fisher Brothers Florists, my life would have taken a drastically different trajectory. However, on this day, I chose to stop at Baskin-Robbins 31 Flavors first, speaking to a Mr. Stecker, the extremely uptight owner who towered over me dressed in a white uniform that made him look like an odd orderly at a mental hospital or a soda jerk out of a 1950s movie. Stiff old Stecker hired me right off the street that day, giving my 14-year-old self my first paying job, nipping my floral possibilities in the bud, so to speak. I would now be sporting an outfit similar to Stecker's, though not quite as committed. I'd be issued a short, white-sleeved shirt, a white apron, and a white paper hat, which along with a smile I was told to wear every day. My job would be to lift the partitions on the backside of the long glass freezers and bend forward to scoop from the round vats of the coveted 31 varieties, fulfilling the needs of the flavor-seeking folks of Evanston, Illinois. Oldstecker hiring me that day set into motion a series of sloppy, take-whatever-job-happens-to-fall-in-my-lap decisions, giving my wheels a few years to spin freely in a job sector I basically despised, the food service industry. I need to make clear again that I was not trolling Dempster Street looking for dough because my family was hurting for cash. No, far from it. Other than fear of my mother's mood swings, there was no need for me to get a job at 14. My fully endowed household would survive and then some without any cash contributions from my end. My father's successful career was bringing in more than enough dough to grant me an allowance. But my father wasn't big on allowances, as he'd grown up poor and he never had one, so why should I? Now, this was not a choice on his part to teach me anything about self-sufficiency. No. It was more that as I had more than he ever had, there'd be no need for me to have anything above what I already had been given, which he never had in the first place. I know, some of you may be thinking that compared to most people, I sound like some fucking spoiled brat, and that may be so. But what did I know about any of that? I was just some kid judging my life by the people who lived all around me, and every kid I knew had an allowance that far exceeded whatever it was old Stecker was paying me. Also, there was a gaping hole in the logic here. Not only was I able to get a job at 14, but I was also able to keep whatever cash I'd earned doing whatever I wanted with it. Even back then, the whole thing didn't make sense to me. If you wanted to control your children with money, the last thing you'd do is let them make dough of their own, right? That just undercuts your own scheme. But nothing my parents did ever made any sense. Look, I was thrilled at the idea of getting a job out of the house. Doing something out there in the world by myself had become an obsession, and I was already plotting to get myself out of that big unhappy house forever. I figured Baskin-Robbins 31 Flavors, or 31 as we called it, would open new horizons for me, and I was excited for all the knowledge and opportunity those flavor-filled freezers were about to bestow upon me. My hope was that it would all ultimately aid and abet my escape. In hindsight, I now know that what old Stecker was after was my youthful underageness. 31 always had a couple underage kids manning the scoops. Thus, Stecker could keep us literal children off the books, paying us less than whatever the minimum wage was back in the mid-1970s. And so, while under the given legal employment limit, I made myself a little dough off the books while sharpening my scooping skills over vats of rainbow sorbet, rocky road, and pralines and cream. The idea that perhaps my time could be better spent never even registered with either of my parents. I was off somewhere in the land of employment, and therefore they didn't have to worry about me. Neither of them even dropped by for a scoop of mint chip. Once I realized that scooping could only get me so far, and wanting to extend my future possibilities, I got myself over to Grove Street and managed to get hired as a dishwasher at a new restaurant that was about to open called The Keg, and that would be one of the first places in Evanston to serve booze since, like, ever. You see, there was once this woman named Frances Willard. She's a crusty old dame who ran the Women's Temperance Union back in the 1880s. Old Frances lived in Evanston in a gingerbread Victorian house over on Chicago Avenue that's now a museum. The thing is, nobody hated booze like those Temperance Union babes, they being the ones that cooked up the whole nationwide prohibition thing in the 1920s. But even before that, these girlies took all that bottled up booze hate and convinced whoever it was who was in charge of the city of Evanston back in the 1880s to outlaw the sale of any kind of alcohol within city limits. It only took Evanston about 90 years to figure out that the no booze thing was not only affecting the bottom line, but also completely ineffective as any sort of societal stance, as the liquor stores at Evanston's southern border with Chicago and on its western border with Skokie were doing bang-up business, not only in package sales, but deliveries as well. And there was the added annoyance of having no decent restaurants in Evanston, as who wants to go out to eat without a little glass of vino? And so finally, the new folks in charge figured out a sort of Evanston compromise, which was not flat-out freedom from Francis. No, it was like they were still afraid she and her temperance gang were ghosting them, so they passed a law that allowed restaurants to serve booze with dinner, but no bars where people could sit around slinging back shots, or something along those lines. Whatever the exact particulars of the new law they put on the books, The Keg became one of the first booze-serving restaurants to open in Evanston in almost a century, and I became an active participant in this post-prohibition world of freedom from booze bondage. With dinner, that is. Although, working as a dishwasher, I'd be as far as one could possibly get from where the drinks were being mixed. But no matter. I was still right there, riding on Evanston's cutting edge. In my sweaty new position, I had the pleasure of piling plates onto a rack, rinsing the loose crud off with a hose that hung from the ceiling, and then shoving them, rack and all, into a hot, steamy dishwashing machine. Then I pressed a wash button, and after a couple minutes, pulled the hot and clean plates off the steamy rack and stacked them up in orderly piles. I also acquired the new skill of scouring baked-on gook off big, round steel pots and pans using baseball-sized steel pads. Although the older guy who was my dishwashing supervisor wasn't thrilled with my results in that area. The keg was very woody inside, by way of long, unfinished planks, the whole place being lit with low-hanging dim lights over deep, leathery booths, and was very up to the minute with the latest experiential dining innovation, a salad bar. Yep, that's right. Greens were finally getting their due, and people were lining up to grab a chilled oval white plate, pick up some tongs, and have a go at all that freshly cut produce. Barely a week had passed before the keg's main manager, a kind of sexy, rangy dude who had a big, porny 70s mustache and a loud habit of getting smashed every night on all this now-available Evanstonian booze, spotted me through the clouds of steam and putting his big hands all over my upper body. Now, people were much more touchy-feely back then. Told me I was a good-looking kid and I should be out on the floor where everybody could see me. He then promoted me to the awe-inspiring and confidence-building title of busboy. This interaction reinforced the belief my mother put in my head that the most important skill one needed for advancement in the restaurant business was the skill to be decent-looking. The keg was hardly my first restaurant rodeo. For as long as I could remember, my family ate out everywhere. We ate out almost every night. And that's no exaggeration. My mother refused to cook, and my entire childhood was spent ordering at some of the best and many of the more mediocre restaurants the Chicago metropolitan area had to offer. In my mother's view, an evening was better spent if you had a waiter who she deemed good-looking, or at least cute. If, unfortunately, a waitress appeared to take the order, she should be young, slim, and for God's sake, put together and attractive. But really, women who chose to be waitresses belonged in the cocktail lounge, not in the dining room, especially if they had some extra poundage on their frame, or worse, a couple decades of toil behind them. In either case, my mother believed that clearly it'd be better for all involved if those type of women found employment at a deli, or better yet, a diner. To 16-year-old me, everyone who worked at the keg was super cool and sophisticated, whatever their weight, age, or sex. They were all outgoing and quick, possessing the magical physical and verbal skills needed to deal with multiple tables filled with multiple customers. They had the ease to laugh and joke through whatever problems were thrown at them, pulling everything together while juggling a bunch of little issues at the same time, sometimes literally. I was in awe and wanted to be as quick as they were. There was a sharp, no-nonsense waitress at the keg, and when I was assigned to work in her section, she'd entrust me to go back to her tables when she was otherwise engaged, you know, to make sure she got an order right or check on this or that or replace something or other, all of which were above and beyond the tasks that most busboys were entrusted to do. She assured me that I had what it took, other than age, to be a waiter myself. That meant a lot to me. So thank you, sharp, no-nonsense waitress, wherever you may be. I perceived at my young, but not missing what was going on in front of me, age, that our buzzed boss had something going on with one of the waiters. One night, I heard this blonde smiley waiter tell another not blonde, not a smiley waiter, what a horn dog our buzzed boss was. Then the two of them started laughing in a low conspiratorial sort of way. From then on, I couldn't help but notice that whenever I worked late, that very same blonde smiley waiter who had blamed all the horniness on our buzzed boss could be found lurking around the corners of the keg pretending to be busy, long after everyone except my old Mexican dishwashing supervisor was gone. By that hour, our not unattractive buzzed boss would be slurring away and Blondie would wave me off, you know, tell me to go home so the two of them could close up. The keg made me cognizant of the fact that I could be making some bank of my own if and when the need arose. The waiters and waitresses there helped fuel my independent spirit, and by the time my 18th birthday swung around, legal at last, I bolted Evanston, moving downtown Chicago into my own little furnished studio apartment. Armed with fake IDs and a healthy dose of self-confidence, I threw myself into a series of waiter jobs over the next 3 years, the shortest being a night or two, the longest lasting almost a year. if one of these jobs ended for whatever reason, I was always able to find another. In reality, my serving skills were somewhere between fair and god-awful. The good news was that I was charming and personable, with a solid Greg Brady, Peter Frampton look, and a quick knowing manner that made for a great interview. People I knew back then called me the Bad Brady, in a good way. Hey, if I came into your restaurant for an interview, you couldn't not hire me, and I knew it. I was quite adept with an application form, the only writing I did back then. My actual penmanship might have been a mess, but it looked very professional service-wise, as I'd already clocked in at some of the most trendy bold-faced names in Chicago, and nobody seemed to mind if I'd been fired from 90% of them. In fact, nobody ever asked. It was enough that I'd been hired in the first place, and I'd stretched out the employment dates between the impressive places, covering over some truly tragic emporiums. The management who hired me usually found me amusing until my third or fourth week, when the dependence on my crack ability to charm would cease to mask my total inability to care about what I found to be the ridiculous minutiae involved in what defines good service. I didn't care if the forks lined up perfectly and held other waiters who obsessed about such nonsense in complete contempt. I was there to make some bank and head out dancing. Period. The way I was able to temporarily mollify these people who surrounded me, many of whom actually wanted to work in the restaurant industry, was to find jobs in the latest up-to-the-moment brand spanking new trendy places that were looking to make a big splash. New trendy places needed fast, funny people who were experienced at opening a restaurant, and as I'd helped open the Keg, I was forever endowed with this priceless resume booster, and I exploited it far beyond its rational value. Yes, I was able to entertain customers while the bumps were being ironed out, and yes, I knew that no matter what, there were going to be plenty of bumps. The people who showed up to a new restaurant first wanted to be ensconced within someplace fun and exciting, even if it was the same basic crowd that showed up to whatever new place was on the docket. They'd all come through to be seen in their new outfits with their attractive new dates, and they'd sniff around making judgments. Not so much on the level of the food and the service, but on the overall coolness of the place. I knew I was safe, at least until the desperate for anything new crowd had all come through and finished up with their sniffing, which took around 4 to 6 months. Bottom line, if you were opening an expensive, fun place where people came to throw some dough and have a few laughs, I was your guy. I knew how to be a part of it, but also when to step aside and let everyone have their fun without any interference from me, and without me standing around at attention like some fucking footman. I'd hold on as long as the wind filled the sails while keeping an eye out for the next possibility so as to be able to jump ship if need be. Once a new place actually proved itself to be a contender to be longer lasting, passing the trendy phase and moving towards a more constant clientele, the whiff of steady cash would fill the air, and that dreaded species, the career waiter, would start circling, looking to pick off weak, shiny assets like myself. Those fuckers were the worst. Management I could deal with. Management was usually busy ordering booze and keeping the owners satisfied. Oh, I'd like to take a second to add that I was often entrusted with waiting on the owners, or famous Chicagoans for that matter, as I could swim in those waters without getting nervous. I understood those people. That was my skill set. Fuck the forks. I had a style about me that I burnished brighter than the stainless steel chafing dishes, and I cashed in on it at every turn. Those finicky fuckers might have been better standing at attention, but the guests with dough recognized my breeding, as my mother used to call it, and I was often asked where I'd grown up and why I wasn't off in school somewhere. None of those career waiters who wanted me gone came from the North Shore. Of that, I'm certain. The kids I grew up with were off in college or spending a year or two in Europe. Even the Evanston fuck-ups had become house painters or were salmon fishing in Alaska or some such shit. Nobody I knew was standing around in fancy restaurants looking put together between bouts of stopping over with the next course of consommé. Those know-it-all fuss-budget career waiters had it out for me, and they really got under my skin. They were usually older and unfulfilled, having forgotten what it was they were initially trying to achieve back when they'd started working in restaurants, and they found ceaseless enjoyment in bringing to light my complete disinterest in folding napkins and all the other ridiculous minutiae they lived for. Watching them twitter over table arrangements made me want to puke. Of course, if I'd owned the place, I would have sided with the career waiters over me any day and fired my ass, too. I mean, inevitably, after the trendy crowd wasn't as important and the customers actually became concerned with whether or not the bread was hot or if there was a smidge of leftover lipstick on their water glass, the target on my back became, shall we say, crystal clear. And so for a few years before I turned 21, I floated between these haunts, all of which were on the near north side, while the kids I once knew were off educating themselves somewhere or other. But I made the most of it. I made some good money in the years before the IRS was paying attention to tips. And the late 70s were all about nightlife, and I'd get off work raring to go with cash in my pockets and more coming tomorrow. There were discos to dance in till dawn and crazy people to run around with, and I really did have a rip-roaring time of it overall. I took multiple trips to New York City and Los Angeles and Fort Lauderdale and Mexico, even just up to Wisconsin, all on my own, dime and otherwise. I bought myself nice clothes, ate out at great places, danced the night away, and didn't rely on anyone. With some truly lousy places interspersed in between, I opened the Keg, I opened the Pearson Room at the mezzanine restaurant Water Tower Place, I opened Carson's Ribs, which is still going strong after all these years. I'd tell a story about Carson's, but I'd rather not sleep with the fishes. I opened Over the Top Dr. Shen's, the first million-dollar restaurant to hit Chicago, or so that's what they said anyway. And finally, I opened Huckleberry's, a private club owned by Barbara Eden, on a chic little stretch of Oak Street. After moving to New York on my 21st birthday, I opened one last restaurant. I'd heard that there was a brand new Hyatt on 42nd Street and Lexington Avenue, and that there was to be a fancy new trendy restaurant opening up somewhere inside of it. I have no idea where or who I heard this from, but given my proclivity for just showing up, I hiked on over to fill out an application. The building had recently opened and shined with acres of green mirror-type glass. It said Grand Hyatt over the entrance, which I immediately found amusing as I entered the atrium lobby overlooking 42nd Street. It wasn't so much grand, it was more like a typical hotel my father would stay in on the road, and it certainly didn't come off very trend-setting. To me, it looked like another lobby of another Hyatt hotel, because that's exactly what it was. But no matter, somewhere in all this cheesy-colored marble and indoor water features, there was to be a cool new restaurant, and I was there to find it. A nice uniformed woman at the front desk on the far side of the lobby pointed me down a hallway behind her, which led away from the light of the lobby and into the bowels of the hotel. I followed the way she told me to go, thinking she may have mistaken my request, as this looked more like a route to the men's room than any way to get to a chic new restaurant. But what did I know? Maybe people in New York City went in for this sort of challenge. As I passed a bank of payphones, I was sure I was heading the wrong direction, but then I came across a double door with a sign over it that said, Trumpets. Having recently arrived from Chicago, any derivatives this name might evoke meant nothing to me. Here, back by the men's room of this so-called Grand Hyatt, I would experience my first encounter with the now inescapable Trump. Apparently, there was some developer dude from Queens who'd made a lot of dough, and now his son wanted to cross the river and make a splash of his own in glittering Manhattan. This developer had greased his son's future by building him his very own hotel to play with. The son's name was Donald, and this Grand Hyatt that I just strolled through was that very hotel. This Donald person had elected to build himself a restaurant that played on the family name within this new hotel of his, and here I was applying for a job at the very same. Trumpets would be the last restaurant I'd ever open. Once through the dark wood front doors, the room itself struck me as trying very hard to be clubby. Now, I never studied design, but it didn't take a degree to see that the tables were so far apart it looked and felt weird. And the overstuffed dining room chairs may have looked okay if they were standing alone in a cocktail lounge near some airport, but they seemed low to the ground and unwieldy, taking up an inordinate amount of space, and I wondered how the guests would be able to eat while sitting so low and so far back from the tables. There were a couple guys not much older than me who looked to be the management team, all dressed up in dark suits, which made them appear like they'd rather be working on Wall Street than in some restaurant near the men's room. One of them solemnly gave me an application, and then another interviewed me with the same seriousness as if this mission to which they'd been entrusted was of grave importance. I chalked it up to the corporate nature of the sort of managers who worked in relatively upscale hotel chains like the Hyatt. I gave my usual song and dance about opening this place and that place in Chicago, and as Hyatt's a Chicago brand itself, I chatted on about my familiarity with all things Hyatt, which I'm sure didn't hurt my cause. Although it all struck me as stiff and odd, I smiled my best smile, shut up and nodded, and they hired me on the spot, even sending me off to be fitted for a brand new tuxedo which was to be made just for me. I chose to stop trying to be so judgy and be happy with my good fortune. Not long after, the new staff was assembled in our soon-to-be-opened clubby-ish room. My fellow new hire seemed nice enough, if a little bland, and I don't remember any waitresses among us, although there might have been a few. But I think they only hired waiters for the dining area, just like my mother liked things to be. Although there were definitely some babes hired to walk the cocktail lounge. By this point, I'd been issued both an ID card and a punch card and had been shown the employee entrance access through Grand Central Station. The first thing I noticed as I walked through that employee-only threshold was that the green reflective glass had not been carried down to this dank entry space, and here before me was a once fancy plaque set into a dirty brick wall that said Hotel Commodore. Wait, what? I thought these Trump people had built a new hotel. But now I realized that the building wasn't new. They just put a skin of reflective green glass over the dirty brick walls of some old hotel called the Commodore, which I found out had been built way back in 1919. All these Trump people had done was slather on some shiny green glass lipstick, bust out a few walls, build out a tacky marble mallish atrium lobby, toss around a few water features, and presto. Now they were calling it not just a new Hyatt, but a new Grand Hyatt. What bullshit. This place wasn't new. One of the hallways behind the front desk leading to Trumpet seemed so odd. That lobby'd been busted out then pasted onto a decades-old building. The whole thing smacked of image fraud. That crusty old Hotel Commodore sign on that beat-up dirty brick wall beneath all that shiny green glass forever bonded in my mind, being the perfect visual representation of what I would forever associate with the name Trump. Bullshit and fraud. The new staff was now all gathered around in the dark, clubbyish room so we would all have the thrill of meeting this Donald person. When he got up and started talking, I remember thinking he was kind of whiny. And then as his whining went on, I started thinking, what a schmuck. But by this point, I was pretty much thinking they were all a bunch of schmucks and he was just another in a long line of them. These career hospitality people were reminding me more and more of the career waiter people I'd loathed back in Chicago. During his little welcome speech, this Donald person kept repeating how classy the place was going to be and how all the classy people in New York would be headed our way for the classy dining experience we were about to give them. My mother hadn't taught me much, but she did instill early on that anyone who used the word classy was anything but. Now, I kept wondering if this Donald person was referring to the kind of cool people who used to flock to the places I'd worked at back in Chicago. I couldn't imagine any of them heading more than once through that mall-like lobby with its cheesy hot and cold running marble to be directed towards the men's room past the payphones to sit in those too low and too far back overstuffed chairs, but okay, what did I know? Besides, I had nothing going on. I figured it'd be entertaining to be proved wrong and see where all this went. Finally, this Donald person stopped jabbering on and on about how great and important the opening was going to be and about all those classy people we'd be serving. And I went home thinking, yuck, that guy was awfully puffed up for some schmo whose father bought him an old hotel that they then pasted a glass facade onto and were now hawking with straight faces some bullshit about it being all grand and all new. I mean, it didn't take a genius to see what a cheap, fraudulent salesman that guy was. Before we opened the front door so the classy masses could experience Trumpets, I'd have to go through more than 2 weeks of training. Yeah, I was used to this. People were always panicked before a restaurant opened because so much could go wrong. But still, more than 2 weeks? I mean, this was a bit excessive. Everyone who'd been hired clearly had previous experience, but these hotel people were really pushing for the perfect fork placement thing. And they were paying us, and it was mandatory, so once again I shut up and smiled. Learning the new menu inside out was something I expected. Being handed an enormous loose-leaf training manual stuffed with pages and tabs and tests and who knows what all, that I was not prepared for. Apparently, I was about to get my PhD in order taking. I had zero interest in continued studies on where the fucking fork goes. I just wanted to make some bank and get out of there. I think we're in like our fifth stultifying day of study, sitting in one of those dull yet very bright hotel conference rooms where you couldn't tell if you were in Des Moines or Cincinnati. This particular scintillating seminar concerned how to scoop the perfect size scoop of ice cream so that the scoop you were scooping was large enough so the guest could enjoy his dessert, but small enough so the Trumpets could maximize their profits. I shit you not. At some point during this fascinating presentation, I gave up the fight to keep my eyes open and snoozed away back behind the other more eager participants. At the break, having roused myself for the exciting afternoon session, which was scheduled to be a group scooping workshop where we would be able to test our newly acquired scooping skills in vats of French vanilla ice cream that I could now see being brought into the conference room. The dark-suited Wall Street wannabe who had managed to keep a straight face while leading this morning's scooping seminar, somehow ignoring the inherent comet possibilities, came over to me and asked me if I was bored. "Why?" I asked. "Because you fell asleep." See, I wanted to hear him say he saw me sleeping, as I wasn't exactly sure what he was talking about. There were so many reasons to be bored. Yeah, I said. "Yeah, I was bored. I used to scoop ice cream when I was 14 back in Evanston, Illinois, and I know how to do it, so yeah, I was a little bored." "Really?" he said. "Yeah," I repeated. "Well, I didn't mean to bore you. And you're fired. You can gather up your things and go, and don't come back." "Gladly," I said, smiling up in his wished he was on Wall Street face. I was considering a dramatic exit, since they were also fucking up tight. But as most of my fellow new hires were off in front of a mirror somewhere buffing their nails or checking their hair, I chose instead to walk off quietly, holding my head up high as I passed by that old Hotel Commodore sign on that dirty brick wall under all that shiny green glass for one last time. I guess you could say I experienced an early rehearsal for all those bullshit-filled rallies yet to come, as well as being one of the first contestants kicked off that reality show, long before any of us had the slightest inkling of what that even meant. You know, it wasn't until I got home that I remembered the tux that was hanging on the door of my closet. Nobody ever mentioned it, so I kept it. Not long after, I was regaling a new crew of waiters at yet another restaurant job about me being fired during that idiotic training session, and I said I kept the tux, and one of them asked me if I'd sell it to him. So I did, for like $70. It's not a lot of dough, less than it was worth, but I figured, fuck it, I didn't want anything from that trumpets fiasco, and I figured I'd never have to hear that name or deal with any of those people ever again. Within a few years, that Donald person would be crossing my path again. Still a couple decades before we'd all have to hear his name on a daily basis.